Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk a bit about topic A, which at the moment is the assault on Israel by Hamas, and perhaps through it by others, as well as where do we go from here? What are the implications of the choices ahead? To discuss these initially, we're going to speak with one of the smartest people I know on all of these subjects. Her name is Shoshana Bryan. She has been one of our go-to experts on the Middle East for, well, as long as I can remember, which is some time. She is also the policy director for the Jewish Policy Institute and an extraordinarily astute observer of the dynamics involved, not just the symptoms of them, but the underlying forces at work, which is one of the reasons why we value her commentary and analysis so much. Shoshana Bryan, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Good morning, Frank. It's nice to be here. Sort of.
I wanted to, under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances.
I wanted just to level set with you about the circumstances just for a moment, Shoshana, to get your sense not only of the obvious that Hamas invaded and massacred and did all kinds of other horrific things, but how that was engineered and by whom.
Okay, there are several levels to that problem, and most of them we're not going to know much about. So let me start by saying, after every major catastrophe in Israel, internal and external, Israel tends to have a commission. And those commissions have been known to be extremely painfully honest. So the real information will come out later. What you can see now is coordination between Iran and Hamas over time. The Iranians admitted it. Hamas admits it. Now the Iranians want to step back just a little bit because they don't really want to be tagged with this. So you have a possibility of Iran having helped, particularly in cyber and mapping and all kinds of other things. That's where they come together. Whether there was an intelligence failure in Israel, a human failure, is unclear. It is clear that there are Israelis who thought Hamas would be constrained, that the fence would be sufficient to keep them inside of Gaza, not in Israel. So there are a lot of problems going around here, and they'll need to be worked over time.
Yeah, but in your professional judgment, you're of the view, I gather, that the Iranians did have foreknowledge of this, had a hand in preparing for it, and may even have been involved in parts of the execution of it?
I don't know about the execution. I absolutely believe the Iranians have been, as the parent to Hamas and to Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They've armed them, they've trained them, they've taught them things. Hamas people have been known to be in Iran training on various things at various times. So do I think there were Iranian soldiers in Gaza? Not necessarily. But the Iranians absolutely, in my view, have culpability here.
Let me ask you about another nation that it turns out had also undertaken in a very public way at the Xi Jinping level conversations with Mahmoud Abbas, which is not the guy who runs Hamas, but is another Palestinian, of course, and may have been, an interlocutor in some fashion with Hamas. I don't know. But the Chinese Communist Party does seem to have not only an interest, but a strategy of creating as much mayhem around the world as they can. Our thesis, we did a wonderful webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger China about this last Friday, is that it's kind of like an arsonist trying to distract the fire department from the big flame that he wants to set off. China may be involved in all of this as well. I wonder what your thoughts are.
China's involved, but I don't think they're militarily involved. I think you're right about the arsonist. The more attention you can distract from Xinjiang province and the genocide against the Uyghurs, the better off China is. So Ukraine war is a huge boost for them. Gaza war, huge boost for them. They go around to other countries and say, look, stick with us. We don't care about your internal politics. We just want to do business. It's not true, but that's what they tell them. And they focus people's attention on the big wars. Takes attention away from them.
Yeah. Well, Xinjiang province is one thing, but I think much more of concern is they want to get people's eyes off of what they have in mind doing in the Western Pacific, presumably to Taiwan,
Also
but
true.
also perhaps to others, including to us. Yeah.
Also true.
And distracting us as well as depleting our resources to deal with that contingency is, I think, all part of a larger plan. Let me ask you about the prospects that, the way this attack was conducted was designed so to inflame Israeli public opinion and sentiment as to assure that Israel would be compelled to go in on the ground in force into Gaza and presumably face the problem that we did in places like Fallujah on steroids. In other words, some would suggest it may be a trap. It certainly is likely to be a very costly affair to both Israelis and, of course, to Palestinians as well. What are your thoughts about that, Shoshana Brian?
They clearly knew there would be a response, and they clearly knew the response was going to be larger than the tit for tat kind of thing the Israelis have done in the past. Yes, you cannot have pogroms, and I use that word advisedly. They sought out women and children, they tortured them, they murdered them. They had to know that a response was coming. The question would be why. But I would point out one other thing that the Israelis have discovered in assessing what happened in Gaza on the ground. Hamas brought supplies with them. They were planning to stay. They thought they were invading Israel and they were going to stay in those places for some period of time. They did not expect the Israeli response on the ground in Israel. Now, did they expect the response in Gaza? I don't know, but I'm still trying to figure out why they thought they were going to occupy towns and communities inside the Gaza Strip, but they did. It didn't work. They're paying the price now. Anyone who didn't think Israel was going to take this on big time wasn't paying attention.
Right. Well, I guess on the ground in Israel, I assume they just figured they would hold out as long as they could, and they would need,
Possibly.
supplies to do that. And frankly, I think they lasted longer than many of us expected they would, maybe for that reason. But on the ground in Gaza is a different kettle of fish, presumably. And I pray, obviously, for the success of this mission. I'm very much of the view that Israel is right now to make clear it intends to destroy Hamas, and there will be no substitute for that decisive outcome, I hope. Shoshana, we're going to have to take a break here in a moment, but let me just introduce the topic that I want to get into with you, and maybe do so briefly initially now. Hezbollah, another terrorist organization, also backed to the hilt by the Iranians, has been exchanging fire and otherwise probing Israeli defenses in northern Israel. Is your view likely to be that that's a precursor to full-on conflict with Hezbollah as well?
Hezbollah is a totally different kettle of fish. The Hezbollah rocket arsenal, which is enormous, it dwarfs what's in Gaza, is there as a retaliatory force if Israel strikes Iran. And for Iran to give that up ahead of time means that Iran becomes vulnerable to Israeli attacks inside Iran. Different kettle of fish, not to say that Hezbollah won't probe, but it's not the same.
So you think they have to be held in reserve as a deterrent to an Israeli attack on Iran itself? It's a
They
very
are the
interesting
deterrent.
thought. We have to hold the thought for further development on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. Much more to come with Shoshana Brian at the Jewish Policy Center, one of the smartest folks we've got on this subject, and we appreciate the chance to visit with her. Stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, the Republican majority of the House of Representatives will confer upon Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio the position of Speaker. At least, that will be the case if the GOP caucus recognizes both the character of this leader, the opportunity his election represents to unify the party's fractious membership, and the necessity of, yes, filling the post now, but in a way, the times demand. Call it the Jordan moment. While Jim made his mark as a principled conservative and founder of the House Freedom Caucus, in recent years he worked closely with Kevin McCarthy and his team. Throughout, however, he's exhibited the decency, personal integrity, and profound faith that have enabled him to garner support from every quarter of his conference. Such qualities will clearly serve him and the country well in the critical days ahead. Godspeed, Jim Jordan. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. And I want to start by making an apology to our guest. Her name, of course, is Shoshana Bryan, but her title is the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center. And I apologize for getting this garbage. Most times she's on, and I'm embarrassed because she's on a lot. And so we'll try to get it right from now on. Shoshana Bryan, we were talking about Hezbollah as a threat to Israel, and you've made the argument that it's an important check on Israeli action against the parent of all of these terrorist operations, namely Iran, and therefore will be held in reserve. I guess my question to you is, do you think that Israel has to preemptively take down the 100,000 or more of these missiles and rockets that are now stashed in southern Lebanon under Hezbollah's control as a means of trying to prevent the kind of destruction that could almost certainly eventuate otherwise?
To be clear, Hezbollah is only a reserve for Iran. If Israel attacks Iran's nuclear capability or some other major attack on Iran, Hezbollah is supposed to be called into to avenge that or to hurt Israel in some way. The Israelis are pretty clear on that. The Iranians are pretty clear on that. Lebanon is a much bigger prize than the Gaza Strip. So you can afford to throw Hamas under the bus, kill a lot of Palestinian civilians. You don't want to do the same.
Sunni Palestinian civilians, as it happens as well, right?
Yes, as it happens. You don't want to do that in Lebanon. It's a much more profitable place to be and a much more important place to be. Now, do the Israelis think they could preempt it or might preempt it? It's in the plans somewhere. I don't know if they're going to call out those plans. However, they have evacuated citizens from the northern parts of Israel that they believe would be retaliated against by Hezbollah. So they're sending them to the south. That is the correct humanitarian thing to do when you have civilians in the line of fire.
Yeah. Well, as I understand, they're sending them southward, but southward. Not all the way to the south, because they've been evacuating the south as well. And I guess two questions occur. One is, Shoshana, the ranges of the missiles that I'm told are now in the arsenal of Hezbollah are sufficient to range the entirety of Israel. And secondly, does the concentration of more of the population in the middle of the country not make them more susceptible to a devastating attack with those missiles or maybe Iranian ones for that matter? And by the way, it's interesting to note that at a time when we're hearing a lot about Palestinians in Gaza being turned into refugees, there are now, by some estimates, 120,000 or so Israelis that are internally displaced as well. But what are your thoughts on those questions?
Well, and the difference is that Israel tries to move them out of the range of fire, and Hamas has been telling civilians in Gaza to stay put, never mind the IDF troops headed your way, don't pay any attention to them. So there's a big difference between internal displacement inside of Israel and inside of Gaza. The Israelis have a system of shelters, a system of humanitarian aid, and the things that they need if they move their civilians from place to place. Some of them actually are going to a lot from the north. I don't know how this works. I don't know how they distribute them,
but they are getting them out of the immediate range of fire and allowing the Israeli armed forces a clean shot at Lebanon if they need to take one.
Right. You know, there's a meme going around, I'm sure you've seen it, that has a terrorist, Hamas, shooting behind a baby carriage at an Israeli soldier shooting back from in front of a baby carriage. And that sort of captures, I think, the point that you've just made.
It does, and it's an old meme, but it's absolutely perfect.
Is it old? Well, it certainly applies to the present moment.
Yeah.
Quick word about Israeli Arabs. Is that a concern as well in all of this? We're hearing calls for days of jihad and so on the West Bank, as well as, of course, in Israel proper.
Two different things. Israeli Arabs, Hezbollah has actually been trying to infiltrate Israel with weapons to put in the hands of the Israeli Arab community. By and large, the Israeli Arab community doesn't buy that. They know better. They see better. West Bank is something else. Palestinians on the West Bank have also been infiltrated. This is mostly by Hamas people. And yes, they're going to be looking for what they can do. On the other hand, they don't want to subject themselves to being Gaza-like. So I think you have to make a big distinction between Israeli Arab citizens, many of whom are in the IDF or work for the social service agencies that serve the IDF, and they are showing up. West Bank, something else.
Interesting. We'll take up with you on another occasion in the West Bank in greater detail, because this is all supposedly about the ending the occupation. And since Gaza is not occupied, at least not yet, it's very important to understand what's going on the West Bank of the Jordan River, the so-called Judean Samaritan high ground. But I did want to reserve some time, and we don't have a lot of it, Shoshana Bryan, to talk with you about President Biden. He has made a point, I think commendably, about his commitment to Israel since this invasion happened. I've been warning, and I think with you on occasion in the past, about the policies of the Biden administration that I believe have contributed to this horrific situation. And we're also hearing the president beginning to introduce ideas about, you know, maintaining humanitarian aid and, you know, trying to ensure that there is a humanitarian corridor for the Palestinians, and that, you know, continues to iterate this idea that the two-state solution is what's needed now. Your thoughts on all of that, please.
There. You just said it. The problem isn't how President Biden or anyone else feels about Israel. I have no problem with that. The problem is that for years, decades now, they have been pursuing policies that, rather than resolving the problem, make the problem worse, because they give Palestinians, including Hamas, including the Palestinian Authority, the idea that they can, in fact, succeed in their goal, which is to eliminate Israel. If this was about statehood for the Palestinians, Palestinians would have taken the state they were offered a long time ago. They reject it because they believe river to sea, and no one corrects them, or very few people correct them.
Meaning the elimination of all of the state of Israel between the Jordan River and
the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. That is the state of Israel. As long as they believe that there is a chance for that, they will go for it. Some of it's brainwashing, but some of it they believe because the American administration tells them that there is a political resolution to this problem. They simply think you can say, no, there isn't. I'm just going to have a war. On top of which, I would point out that Iran's people are yelling at the administration about the $6 billion, right? The frozen money. Never mind the $6 billion. I can't believe I said that. Never mind $6 billion. Iran's foreign currency reserves have risen under this administration from about $12 billion to about $100+ billion. That's a huge cache of money that is not constrained, that is not for humanitarian aid. It's the result of waivers on oil sales to China. There's your Communist Party, Frank, and a lot of other people. So the policies encourage the war. The president doesn't encourage the war personally. The policies do directly encourage the war, and they are very problematic. And by the way, one last point, The Israelis don't need the Biden administration to tell them how to deal with humanitarian aid and corridors. They don't need it.
Right. Well, this is the crux of the matter, I think, is the policies that have gotten us to this point have contributed to this war.
Yes.
My concern is that the same people who brought us those policies, the people doing business as Joe Biden, for want of a better term, are intent on restoring, I think, those policies and pursuing them even more aggressively in the days to come. We'll have to have you back, Shoshana Bryan, to talk about the implications of that for the present crisis, to say nothing of those that may yet be in the offing. But for a moment, let me simply say thank you for the great work that you do at the Jewish Policy Center as its senior director. We're very grateful to you and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with more with another of our duty experts, Ilan Berman. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome to our next expert on national security writ large, but also on the Middle East. His name is Dr. Ilan Berman. He is the vice president for a terrific organization, the American Foreign Policy Council here in Washington, D.C., and a man I've been privileged to know and work with for a long time and regard very highly for his acumen on all of these matters. And I'm sorry that we haven't talked more recently, but we're delighted to do so today. Ilan Berman, welcome back to Securing America.
Well, it's great to be back. Thanks, Frank.
Gosh, a lot to talk about, not a lot of time. Ilan, your quick take on what happened in Gaza and with respect to the success in perpetrating this horrific invasion.
Right. Well, I know you guys have covered this before, so just the 30-second version. I think it's we're in a grave new world. What you saw internally in Israel is a multi-domain governmental failure. It's a failure of intelligence. It's a failure of security. It's a failure of the protection of communities in the south of the country. And in the aftermath, there's very clearly going to be a reckoning in terms of Israeli politics after the current conflict is over. But even now, we're beginning to see a pretty fundamental reset of how Israel thinks about the Palestinian arena more close in, but also about normalization with the Arab world, also about the threat of Iran. There is a sense among Israelis that the government miscued very fundamentally, but also that they were lulled into a sense of complacency, that over the last 3 years, the euphoria of a new Middle East had really blinded them to the dangers that were still clear and present.
Miscued is an interesting term. What do you mean by that?
I think there is a sense, and certainly Israel is a country that I've traveled to, you know, very many times, twice this year already. Everybody that I've talked to in the last 3 years has been leaning very heavily on the idea that we've really crossed the Rubicon. Israel has now opened relations with the rest of the Middle East, or the majority of the rest of the Middle East. Israel is less isolated, and therefore the old paradigm of security first is no longer applicable. And so they miscued on things that they otherwise would have responded to: preparations for armament on the part on their northern border on the part of Hezbollah, preparations for armament in the Gaza Strip on the part of Hamas, the linkages that Iran has. There was a sense that we sort of had passed this phase already, and it really sort of came back to bite in a really horrific fashion.
In a big way. We talked with Shoshana Bryan a little bit, but I'd like to get your take on it as well. Ilan, you've studied Iran closely. What do you make of their role in all of this?
Well, I think it's very clear that Iran is the chief arsonist here. Hamas may have perpetrated the atrocities, but the stage was set through Iran's long, deep, extensive sponsorship of Hamas. Iran provides hundreds of millions of dollars a year to Hamas and other terror proxies. And, you know, I think it's very facile for the White House to say there's no direct intelligence linking the Iranian regime with these current terror attacks, right? There may not be a smoking gun email that says, go, now is the time to go. But it's undeniable that Iran created the conditions that made this possible through its infiltration of the Palestinian arena, through its armament of Hamas, through its propagation of this extremist rhetoric and the calls for Israel's destruction. So Iran very much lit the match here.
It's interesting you use that term, arsonist, because we did a program, as I mentioned in the previous block, last week, under the sponsorship of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, talking about Xi Jinping as the uber arsonist. Talk about the relationship between China and Iran, and in fact, even the Palestinians, it appears, that may have been at work in all of this, and how this might benefit the Chinese Communist Party's agenda to have a new flashpoint in the Middle East.
Right. Well, I mean, there's two things here. There's where we were up until now and where we're going moving forward. Where we are currently is a product of the fact that the Chinese have spent a lot of time in a much more holistic fashion than most people understand, building this sort of web of strategic partnerships in the Middle East. And the partnership with Iran, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which resulted in a quarter century, $300 billion trade and military cooperation pact back in 2021, was a function of that. Iran is a key node along China's Belt and Road. And at the time when that agreement was struck, it was struck as a result of Iranian weakness. Iran was coming off of sanctions applied by the Trump administration. Iran's foreign exchange reserves had dwindled to almost nothing. The Iranians were willing to give up part of their sovereignty in order to remain solvent. Where we are now is that the Iranians are in a much more stable economic position, thanks in no small part to the lax sanctions enforcement that you have on the part of the Biden administration. And as a result, Iran has begun to spread its wings in the Middle East, right, through stepped up activism in a whole host of places, but including in the Palestinian arena, right? That's how we got here, in part. Where we're going is that the Chinese government is very carefully triangulating and trying to figure out where this conflict is going to go. One of the real interesting and unspoken dividends of the Trump administration's approach to the Middle East was the fact that the National Security Council and the administration writ large had leaned very heavily and very constructively on Israel to trim out their ties to China, right? Israel is the startup nation. They had thrown open their doors to Chinese investment. And the Trump administration, at the same time as it gave Israel a lot of what they wanted, right, sovereignty over the Golan, normalization with the Arab world, was telling them, you really need to slow down. You need, you know, there's a downside risk to this deep investment with China. And the Israelis listened. The relationship between China and Israel, which was very robust, is now on the downswing. It's still very, very robust in economic terms. It's something like $21 billion of turnover trade annually, but it's a fraction of what it was before. And China's relationships with the Arab world are much bigger. So the policymakers in Beijing are looking at this environment and they sort of understand where their bread is buttered. The money flows to the Arab world. The Arab world is divided, but at least for the moment, seems very anti-Israeli, very pro-Palestinian, very pro-Hamas. And so the position that Beijing—
Thanks in part to this whole invasion and what's flowed from it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I would argue before that it was not so much. That was a good thing, I believe, for all involved, all of us at least, and Israel. But Ilan, just on this, we'll be talking more about the economic piece of this with Bill Walton in a moment. But I did just want to ask you, Israel, it seemed to me, was actually pursuing more aggressively a relationship with China post-Trump, when it was being, I think, badly treated by the Biden administration, as we talked about a little bit with Shoshana. Was that operating?
Yes and no, right? So what you have is you have the political and you have the economic, right? In economic terms, the relationship was definitely less robust than it was before. And that, you know, credit to the last administration for that. Politically, that's absolutely right, right? Politically, the pressure that this White House has brought to bear on Israel had led the Israeli government to begin to at least attempt to signal that there are other options on the table. And that includes cozying up to Beijing. I think—
As had the Saudis.
Right. And I think in the aftermath of all that, what we've seen over the last several days, I think all of that is gone.
Right. Ilan, you've spent a lot of time, as has the American Foreign Policy Council, trying to make book about and warn of organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, which are intimately involved in all of this jihadism around the world. The Hamas, lest we forget, is, as you know so well, the Palestinian franchise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about the infrastructure that has been built out by these guys with help from our old friends, the Turks under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as well as the response, I think preliminary to be sure, but nonetheless, the response to date from this call for the Day of Jihad here as well as elsewhere.
Right. Well, so starting with that first, I think, thankfully, the response to the Day of Jihad was distinctly underwhelming, right? And I think when Ismail Haniyeh, the political head of Hamas, when he called for a Day of Jihad, what he was trying to do was actually certainly stoke the embers of sort of what he had created, but also to calibrate the freedom of action that he will enjoy if there's more atrocities, right? It was essentially a opinion poll in the West and in the Muslim world about how popular what his organization had just done had been. And I think the response that he got was a little bit chastening. Certainly here in the United States, it was distinctly underwhelming. There were, you know, a couple of sporadic, very small scale rallies. It was, of course, abhorrent that Jewish institutions felt the need to close throughout the country, right? Synagogues and Jewish day schools and whatever it is. But in terms of actual disturbances, we didn't really see much. That's not the case in other places, right? In places like Pakistan, rallies in London, you know, things like that. So there are things to be concerned
about. But
even
in New York, it was a little sporty, wasn't it?
No, even in New York, and certainly, you know, and this is a completely different conversation, but on American elite university campuses, you know, what you've seen is this sort of incubator of intolerance under the guise of inclusive leftist progressive ideology, which is now, thankfully, I think, you know, it's having a gut check moment where there are donors who are closing their checkbooks, like the Huntsman Foundation, closing its checkbooks to precisely this sort of intolerance.
Let's hope so. And apparently some Wall Street firm saying they don't want to hire the guys who have been involved in it. Let's hope that keeps up. Come back soon, if you would, Ilan, for a longer conversation. It's great to see you again. And thanks for your insights, as always. We'll be right back, as promised, with Bill Walton right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, the Republican majority of the House of Representatives will confer upon Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio the position of Speaker. At least, that will be the case if the GOP caucus recognizes both the character of this leader, the opportunity his election represents to unify the party's fractious membership, and the necessity of, yes, filling the post now, but in a way the times demand. Call it the Jordan moment. While Jim made his mark as a principled conservative and founder of the House Freedom Caucus, in recent years he worked closely with Kevin McCarthy and his team. Throughout, however, he's exhibited the decency, personal integrity, and profound faith that have enabled him to garner support from every quarter of his conference. Such qualities will clearly serve him and the country well in the critical days ahead. Godspeed, Jim Jordan. This is Frank Affney. Each time this week for us to visit with Bill Walton. He is the host of The Bill Walton Show these days. He is also a man informed by some very formidable experience as a master of the universe on Wall Street with Allied Capital, and also as a conservative leader at the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. Bill Walton, welcome back, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, great talking with you as always.
Bill, I wanted to start with you by talking about a very important report that was pushed out without a whole lot of fanfare, though it did get a bit of a write-up in the Financial Times last week. It's from our friends at the Coalition for a Prosperous America, and it talks about a problem that, frankly, I think even those of us who have been concerned about China's presence in our market didn't really fully appreciate the extent of it. Talk to us about what are A shares, Bill, and what this report suggests is their penetration of not just the market, but specifically the portfolios of people holding Vanguard, FTSE Russell, exchange-traded emerging market funds.
Well, we would need about 20 minutes to explain A shares in their full glory, but essentially, what's happened is over the last couple decades, there have been all sorts of convoluted rules and classes of shareholdings put in place so that companies could invest in China, and originally it was so you could invest without being a partner to the Chinese Communist Party. That seems to be less of an issue today. But it's a way for U.S. investors to own shares without claiming they don't really own shares. And the biggest offenders of this are what they call the big three in the investment business. That would be our friends at BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. They all control about $20 trillion of investor assets. And they don't seem to have gotten the message that China has declared war on the United States, and their economic interests are trumpeting our national security interest, and they continue to hold shares in a lot of companies which are part of the pardon the pun, but the vanguard of China's aims at destroying the United States. They've got about holdings in about 60 subsidiaries of China's military industrial complex companies. They've got 20 companies in the portfolio denied access to U.S. technology because they're deemed military end users. And they've also got investments in the Chinese quantum information technologies, artificial intelligence, and microelectronics. you know, big words, but simply these are technologies that can be used in weapons aimed at the United States and probably sooner Taiwan.
Okay, so let me just make sure I'm clear about this, because for some time, thanks, I believe, principally to Joe Biden, who engineered this memorandum of understanding between the United States and China when he was vice president, Chinese companies have been able to have access to our capital markets without conforming to our laws and regulations, specifically with regard to the financial viability of the company, not subject to audits, for example, of any particular quality. And Bill, what A shares involve, as I understand it, is something even less reputable than those that are in our markets officially. And you say that they can be held by investors without the investors' knowledge that they're being held, these A-shares?
I think it's a distinction really without a difference, Frank. The point is Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock continue to want to invest in Chinese companies. And, you know, we've seen everything we've done to prevent us from supporting the Chinese intentions against the United States. It's like a sieve. I mean, you look at the Chinese, you look at what the Commerce Department has done, supposedly imposing tough restrictions on the sale of semiconductors to China. And as our friend Derek Scissors over at AEI points out, that they're talking about licenses, not outright bans on these sales. And the companies involved can get around these license requirements 53 different ways. It's a world market. There are thousands of intermediaries. There are many other countries you can buy and sell these security or these this technology through. And you know, it's just a lack of seriousness and an unwillingness to recognize the true situation with China.
I want to come back to the Scissors comment in a moment, if I can, Bill, just to tie this up. The A shares, I guess the distinction is that there's a relatively small number, I think 260 or so, Chinese companies, including, I think it's fair to say, some that have ties to the Chinese Communist Party's military-industrial complex, some that have been involved with, you know, human rights abuses, slave labor, and the like. And some that are just simply, you know, an invitation to financial disaster. But what's different about the A shares is apparently there's thousands of these companies that are now held by people who almost certainly, if you're a pension fund, you know, beneficiary, for example, yeah, BlackRock or State Street or Vanguard may have put your money into these things, but you didn't probably know it. So you may have material risk exposure that you're unaware of. And Bill, as we've been talking about in recent weeks, people are finding it harder and harder, if not effectively impossible, to get your money out of China. So I would suggest that, you know, this multiplication of the exposure is a big deal. And I salute our friends at the Coalition for a Prosperous America, Roger Robinson.
Well, Frank, I've been involved in putting deals.
I got to take a break. We're going to take a timeout. We'll be right back with you and more. Bill Walton, hold the thought. More on fraud and the perpetration of it against us in connection with the Chinese Communist Party right after this. We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with the great Bill Walton. He is one of our favorites and regulars here at Securing America. We're grateful, in addition, for what he does in his day job as the host of the Bill Walton Show, which I strongly commend to all of you. In fact, we're going to be taping a segment with him, with our colleague and friend, Dr. Bradley Thayer, later this week. We look forward to that greatly. Bill, we were talking about this idea that maybe it's not a good time to be investing anywhere in China, especially in People's Liberation Army related companies, and they all are in one way or another. There was a rather unlikely amen of sorts uttered by a fellow by the name of Ray Dalio to our concerns about the idea of further investing in the CCP. Tell us what he said at Greenwich, I understand, last week, and what it suggests about a possible shift in perceptions, at least of some in the financial sector, about the viability of investments in China.
Well, one of the favorite maxims, my favorite maxims in the investment business, is you need to face reality as it is, not as it was or you wish it to be. And Ray Dalio, regardless of what we may think of his views about China, is a very successful investor, and he looks like he's beginning to face up to the reality of what's happening with China. He was at, I think, one of his sponsored investment conferences in Greenwich last week, and he opened up by saying that it looks like what's going on with this ban in semiconductors and cutting off technology to China, he said that was similar to what the United States did to Japan in the run-up to World War II by banning oil for gasoline exports to China and essentially cutting off China, or Japan, cutting off Japan's economy and trying to shut them down. And that led to Pearl Harbor. And so what Ray is saying, I don't think he quite approves of it, but he does think these sanctions or these licenses or these bans that we may be putting in place is provocative, and it's going to make things worse rather than better. But now he's recommending investments in Japan, which is highly ironic in a way, if you think about this story I just told. And in particular, he's interested in green energy, green in Japan. And so, like all gimlet-eyed investors, he's moved from China, at least going forward, to Japan. And I think he's taking a wait and see as to what's actually going to happen as events develop in China.
Yeah. And I understand he did utter the phrase irreconcilable issues between the United States and China. Is that correct?
I think that's yes, he did use exactly those words, irreconcilable issues with regard to Taiwan. And that I think that's an accurate statement. That the Chinese Communist Party wants Taiwan back in the fold, and they will do whatever it takes to do that. And
indeed.
Of course, we can't compromise there, or we shouldn't. So,
well, we can lose it, though, I'm afraid is the point. And we've been discussing that earlier in the program with some of our other guests. But Bill, on this question, I do wonder whether Ray Dalio is getting his money out of China under these circumstances, or whether he's even tried, because that would be interesting to know. Is he, walking the walk, but also whether he can get it out of China?
He's probably hedging. He's in so deep, I think getting out is not really that easy for him. And as we pointed out, a lot of his investments and other investments are in illiquid securities, and also subject to currency controls and security laws in China, and they can shut down your taking your money out at any moment. And
right. Sure, well, I think that's that. I think that's true of people who are not even in so deep, but may just simply be, regular investors who want out. But Bill, let me talk to you about one other piece. We've been talking a lot about Israel in the course of the program, and among other things, whether China has been involved in creating these horrific conditions at the moment through their proxy, Iran specifically, but also there's been some talk about direct engagement with the Palestinians that may have encouraged all of this. I just wonder what your thoughts are, Bill. I heard a report with our friend Josh Phillips at Epoch Times the other day, in which one of his experts was talking about how the Chinese may not only want to have this major distracting preoccupation for the United States in the form of its second front, if you will, but also that it may be angling to get some sort of new arrangement or expanded arrangement, if you will, with Israel to gain even more access to its sensitive high technology by brokering some kind of understanding with China's client, Iran. What are your thoughts?
It's been unreported, but we need to keep in mind that China's ties, economic ties and technical ties, technology ties with Israel run very deep. Chinese has more than $15 billion invested in the Israeli economy. And China is second only to the United States in the collaboration that it has with high-tech firms, as stated by the Israeli office, Israeli chief scientist, I'm not sure what his title is, but it may have overtaken, China may have overtaken the United States in its investment in China. And there are lots of technologies that China's developed. I'm sorry, Israel's developed. Israel's called the startup nation. And most of the startups, 20, 30, 40% of them are in the technology business. And they own and have developed lots of interesting technology that I'm sure China would like not only have an economic interest in, but in fact to control. And I'm sure China's worked a lot of the licensing agreements that they've worked with U.S. companies. But the other angle of this is that if China does align with Iran and Hamas and switches sides, they may have designs on the Chinese, on the Israeli technology that they wouldn't have to pay for. They would just take it. It's a little bit like Taiwan, though, Frank, because
Bill, I got to let you go. Comparison we'll make the next time. Thank you so much, my friend, for your time today. Come back to us next week if you would. I hope the rest of you will do so next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.